Okay, so Emily Strange.
I'm Mary Birch.
I'm Anna Birch.
Cool. Did you want me to ask both of you? Yeah.
Yeah, if that suits you, that's good.
Fine.
You do what you want.
How did you find yourself at the camp, and how long were you there for?
How did I what?
Find yourself at the camp. Like, how did you get there, and how long were you there for?
Well, I'd been supporting peace movements for God knows how many times.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd always gone marching and all that stuff. And there was quite a group of, mostly at that time, the people that I knew were Quakers. And we had a group of people who met every month or so and discussed the terrible situation.
Yeah.
And then we got to know about Greenham. And so some of us decided we'd go and see if there was anything we could do to help. So that's what we did.
Yeah.
And I went to a Quaker school, and because my mum and dad were, they were anti-nuclear, basically. So I was brought up with that and thought it was very important from a young age.
Nice. Could you explain why you think it's important that Greenham is remembered for subsequent generations?
Yeah, explain what?
Can you explain why you think it's important for Greenham to be remembered by subsequent generations?
I can't understand. Tell me.
So, why is it important to remember Greenham for young people?
Well, I don't know that it's particularly important. I mean, we were just a group of women. And by the time we went to the camp was established by a few people at Orange Gate. And gradually the knowledge about the camp was spreading, partly because there was quite a lot of publicity, because, of course, nobody wanted it there except the women who were there.
No.
And those of us who were helping, and people helped from all over the south of England.
Yeah.
And gradually it got, well, it was a sort of long-term argument between the government and the women. And we didn't, for one thing, most of them were anti-war and had been on peace marches and so on. And other people were just furious because the government had come in and said that had allowed the Americans to come and take a piece of land, which after all was common land, and common land meant that it was land that didn't belong to anybody and should be used by people of the area. It was often used by people years ago for sheep or cattle or drying, washing or meetings of people. Common land meant that it didn't belong to anybody except those around. So there was certainly there was no truth in the fact that the government should allow Americans to come and make an airport there. They did it in a lot of places. I think there were 16 airports, American airports in the south. I only visited one other besides Greenham, but Greenham was the biggest one. So that's how it happened. And gradually people got to know more and more about it, and women started coming and staying the night. And that's what happened.
And I think it's important for young people to know about it because, for example, with the climate change actions at the moment, people think that they're starting something new, but actually it's very similar because it's peaceful action. And I think that's what we were most supportive of the Greenham women about, was because they were taking non-violent action.
Yeah.
That was what it was.
So not.
Do you want to move in a bit, Mara, or are you comfortable?
No, I'm quite comfortable.
Good. All right, we won't move you then.
So great. Not trying to achieve things by being forceful or...
That's right.
...or, like, physical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That makes sense. Cool. Were you at a gate in particular?
So look directly at Ma.
What?
Look directly at Ma and speak really loudly to her.
Which gate did you join?
What?
Which gate did you join? Were you at a gate there?
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
What state?
Gate.
Was I in?
Yeah, which gate were you in? Which part?
What state was Greenham in?
Like what, I'm trying to think of another word.
What gate did you join? Which gate did you like?
Gate.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know. You know what date it was.
No, gate, Ma, like the orange gate. Which gate?
Well, I went to the orange gate.
Yeah, tell Emily.
You perhaps got this from someone else that very soon there were enough women and divided up all round the whole area in different gates, and the orange gate was the main gate, and I used to go there partly because I knew people who were there and partly because we had a camper van and we used to take a lot of stuff and bring a lot of stuff and that was easy to leave it there and then it was distributed. And the gates, in a way, some of them were very almost private. I mean, the green gate and the yellow and the green gate were very anti-men, and they wouldn't even let my husband drive the van near to deliver wood to them. Just no men were allowed anywhere near.
Really? Wow. No. Can you tell me a bit more about the day-to-day running of the camp? How you bought in sort of toiletries?
Well, I think that there wasn't any day-to-day running because it just depended what happened in the day.
Right.
You see, sometimes nothing particular happened. And at the beginning, they had tents. Well, then the tents got ripped up by the American soldiers came out, the police came, God knows who came, and simply ripped up the tents, pulled up the tents. So when it was like that, then they had to try and gather themselves together and make some sort of covering to sleep under. And after a few weeks, they got into shape. And I don't know who taught them how to do this, but they started making benders, which was when you got early soft wood, bent it over, joined it at the top. So it was like an igloo made of branches, which was a little bit of a cover for them, but not very much. But I think most of the day was spent with women. They had to go and get the water that they wanted, and some of them would go into, what's the name of that?
Newbury.
And the Quaker women in Newbury helped them quite a lot, and they would go into Newbury and use the washing machines and things like that. I suppose the whole day was spent gathering up the strength and eating what food they'd been given or cooking on a fire and hoping that that nobody was going to come in and leave them alone. But most days they were disturbed by either the soldiers from the camp or the police, or of course there were other people who thought we were dreadful. I mean, there was no such thing as a woman's movement in those days. I mean, you know, if you were a feminist, you hadn't got a group to visit or anything, because it just, a woman was just someone who did the work, got married, looked after the kids, probably did a job as well. And most of us were just like that. But some of us had husbands who were very supportive, like mine was, but others didn't. And quite a lot of women eventually left their husbands and, come to that, their children, and came to live at Greenham. But at the beginning, Greenham was in such a mess I mean, it was just ghastly. It was muddy and they didn't have a loo. They had to just go in the bushes and they just never knew who was going to come. And gradually they divided up into different patches all round the centre, all round the camp. And they, each of them were slightly different because they brought in women who they knew, of course.
Yeah.
So I don't know what all these people did over the other side of the camp. I only know that was the entrance and the feminist camps, and on the other side here, I think it was Purple Camp, which were a lot of overseas people. That's where Tony was.
Oh, was it?
American people came. But as for what you asked me, what do they do in the day? They just managed to survive.
And what did you take in the van for them?
Well, we used to take a lot of wood because they were, and stuff for fires. And we also used to bring back from there blankets and sleeping bags. And I'd got a very good washing machine that washed and dried things quite quickly. So we were just going backwards and forwards. I guess we went every week and took them back clean blankets. And I collected food. You know, people would give me food to take. And we just took everything that we could that would be helpful.
Mm. Do you want to tell Emily about the daisy chain?
Yes, well, that was later on.
Have some water. It's hard, isn't it?
I think if they listen to this, people will think, this old girl must have been there years ago. Well, it was. How many years ago?
30.
30.
So you were sort of 63. You were the same age as me, basically, when you went. I'm 62, by the way.
Now, the daisy chain came a bit later because that was when we then knew what was in this camp, and that was era of
cruise
planes
and cruise
and what
cruise missiles.
Yes, they were cruise missiles. I mean, actually, nobody ever knew what was in the camp really, but this is what was reckoned to be in there, that the Americans had set all these camps all over the place which would have airmen, trained airmen, and planes and missiles. And when they were ordered, they would fly out. God knows where they were going to drop all these missiles, I don't know. But on other military bases that they knew, and over to France, I suppose. But obviously, an awful lot of the women round the base, I would think the majority of them had got children, because that's why they were so livid about what was happening. Mm. And determined that they could do what they could to stop all this. And so they had an arrangement whereby anybody found out that the army was, that the American army was going in or coming out of this
of the base camp. base of the base,
which was, the base was, and I don't know, you perhaps remember how big it was, but it was
massive.
Pretty big,
yeah.
And there were lots of tents, but also a lot of sheds and things with offices in, and places where the men ate or whatever they did. Anyway, when anybody heard that they were going to move, and what we knew was that some of the time they were going to practice bringing the aircraft out of the base. They weren't loaded, as far as we knew at that time, but they were pulled out of the base and with lorries and driven round.
That's right.
Just for a sort of practice, I suppose. And then also the lorries would come out full of men and just generally using their influence over the area. And we really didn't care for that. So somebody, and I don't know who it was someone who lived in Newbury, started the idea that if anybody knew that any movement was happening in the base, which meant that people were coming out of the base into the country, particularly if it was lorries or planes, we would phone up all the people who could be gathered, who would drive immediately and block up all the roads around the base. And so that's what we did. And in Bristol, it happened that I'd got I was fairly central to most people where I lived in Bristol. And also I'd got a lot of room for people to park and a lot of room inside to store things. So people used to bring stuff to my house and then we'd have meetings. Well, then we started thinking we must help them with the cars in the road. And I don't know who it was started this. It wasn't me, but it was at my house, a daisy chain, which meant there was one person in the centre, and that happened to be me, because it was my house, I suppose. And round, with the numbers of the clock, were different people with their phone numbers. So somebody at the base would phone me and say, alert. So I had to phone 12 o'clock, and 12 o'clock phone 1 o'clock, all the way around. So all these women were told to be alert and get ready to drive to Greenham. And that's what they did. And sometimes, more often than not, we didn't do anything because we'd then hear that nothing was happening.
The missile wasn't coming out. The missile wasn't coming out.
Yes, that nobody was coming out of any importance, or they'd heard about it. Because, I mean, everybody had got spies all over the place. There were people in the camp who told us stuff, and people in our camps who told the soldiers stuff.
Yeah.
And then we'd hear, well, actually, we're not going to block up the roads today. But from time to time, we really thought that was the best thing to do. And of course, as soon as we started blocking up all the roads, they simply went back into camp because they couldn't move.
Wow.
So they created roadblocks, and also this is before mobile phones. So the woman in Newbury picked up her phone at home and rang you, and then you picked up your phone home and rang round.
There were no mobile phones or anything like that.
It's all before that.
Everybody who was concerned with it was quite convinced that all our phones were tapped.
Yeah.
And I don't know, who knows whether they were or not. I mean, people would hear noise and reckon that that's how we were tapped. And I mean, I'm more cynical about that now, but at the time when you're involved with all this emotionally and you hear strange noises and you know that they're after you, then you sort of hear things that perhaps were nothing at all, but we all thought that we were tapped. And certainly several of the women had been in prison because they'd either, two women once got over the fence and into the camp, that only happened once, and they were taken to court and imprisoned. But quite a lot of women were in prison just for a day or 2 days or something, because they probably managed to hit one of the Air Force chaps or hit one of the politicians or something like that. And they knew who we were. I mean, one time when I went, I had finished taking the stuff in and I'd got all these blankets and sleeping bags in this camper van, and I stopped the van on a road near to Greenham, really preparing myself to drive back. And a policeman came along on a bicycle and stopped and got off and came and said, "What are you doing here?" So I said, "Well, actually, I'm carrying a few blankets to my house to wash." why are you asking? So he said, well, I think that you're to do with Greenham Common. I said, well, maybe you're right. So what? I can leave. Well, he said, I shall book you. You're not supposed to park here. I said, well, that, of course, is rubbish. This is an ordinary country road. And I'll show you on the map, which I did.
Yeah.
So he said, well, I shall make a report and you'll probably have to appear in court. I said, well, look, why don't we both go down to the police station now and sort it out? I can't be bothering with coming to court.
Yeah.
So he wasn't very pleased with that, but we went back down to the police. They'd got a block of, I don't know, sheds and things and an office there. And a big counter. So I was told to go in and stand by the counter. And there were quite a few people behind, one of whom was asking me questions. Whose car was it and how, what was my name before I was married? And where was I married? And did I have a job? I mean, masses of things. Just ridiculous. So I said, well, I don't know what all this has got to do with it. If you want to know, I don't mind. So this was all put onto a computer, which was very early then. You didn't have things all over the place. And they said, you realise that what you tell us must be the truth because this will go straight to number 10. So I said, oh, really? What on earth is... What do you think is going to happen then? So they said, well, you might laugh now. It's not a laughing matter. You'll be called to court. I said, for what exactly? So they said, well, you were parked or you shouldn't have parked. And you haven't been serious about answering these questions. I said, well, I'm perfectly serious. So then one of them said, well, actually, we think that you've come from Cuba. I said, well, no, not actually. Do I look as though I come from Cuba? At that time, I was very, very blonde, naturally. Straight blonde hair and very thin. So, I mean, nobody could be less Cuban, really. So they said, oh, well, we have information that these people are coming and we're going to meet, I just remembered this, we're going to meet them off the train and then they won't be able to get to the camp. So I said, well, look, let's concentrate on this. What, you've got enough information from me and I'm going home now. So they'd got my address and phone number and all this absolute rubbish. And I went home and I never heard any more about it, except that they had told me that all the names that they'd taken would go directly to number 10. And Margaret Thatcher would make sure that all these people were reported to all sorts of work where they were, and oh, just awful. And it did in fact affect certain things that we knew about. So that's what it was like.
And you felt that they'd taken your details and perhaps had affected your phone and perhaps
we
Pa.
We didn't know what it was.
Because
I
Pa
mean,
was
in 1 minute,
director
you think,
of the Polly at the time,
this
wasn't he?
This is just ridiculous. We're just friends and we like meeting. Mm. And another minute you think, my God, I mean, we're doing something vital because if these planes get out with nuclear stuff. Mm.
No.
So it was a very emotional time. And it was very emotional for the Greenham women who were living there. And some of them were there for months. Mm. And some of them just went for one night every so often. I had an American friend who always went every couple of weeks, just for a night. Mm. And a lot of people did. I never attempted to go for a night because I'd got young children at home.
Yeah.
And I really, to tell you the truth, I didn't fancy going and sleeping in a bender if I didn't have to. And a lot of them enjoyed this. A lot of them became lesbian, which was not surprising in the awful situation that they were. And actually, unfortunately, a lot of marriages broke up.
Yeah.
Very. Well, it wasn't quickly, because when the marriages broke up, they were really a lot of women who were unhappy in some way, and then suddenly they got this freedom of doing what they wanted to do. And,
yeah.
And there was a great deal of friendship between the women.
Yeah.
So we went on doing this for I don't know how long.
Good few years.
How many?
2 or 3 years, I should think.
Oh, yes, it was certainly several years. I'm sure somebody's got a proper diary. I expect Jean probably.
Yes, that's right.
Of dates and stuff.
Exactly.
One of the really hard things was that Heseltine, who was then a Member of Parliament, he wasn't a Lord at that point, he was a very important Conservative Member of Parliament, and he supported Margaret Thatcher, and this ghastly lot of people tried to get rid of the Greenham women. And often they would have everything torn down one day. By the time they'd built their benders up and collected more, all their food would be chucked out, their clothes chucked out. It was just horrific. And by the time they'd got things together, in came the troops and did it again. And it was, I don't know how they managed to really live there. I really don't. Mm. And they were just, I mean, you know, when they were ill, they had to go into, there wasn't a doctor at the camp. They had to go into Newbury and see a doctor. It was just, it was really awful. And although I and my group in Bristol kept on doing this for quite a while,
yeah,
it was nothing compared with the women who actually lived there. I don't know how the ring around the camp started.
Embrace the camp.
What?
Embrace the camp.
Yes, I don't remember whose idea that was.
Yeah.
It wasn't from our gate, but this was suggested we'd have Embrace the Camp. And by that time, we had enough women. You see, I don't remember what the size of the camp
was. No, we can find that out.
It was miles and miles round with this awful wire up. And so we had Embrace the Camp, and that meant that all the women who possibly come, we'd all hold hands and go right round the whole camp.
It was amazing.
And that's what we did do. And there were 26 busloads from Bristol went.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes, it was quite extraordinary. We were all excited about it. And we took some people brought their children, and a lot of people brought photographs of their children or babies' garments. We hung all these things on the fence, so if anybody came along, they could see pictures of babies and babies' clothes and children's school clothes and all sorts of charges, toys and things, because it was essentially a thing of save our children. We're doing what we can, but save our children. And it went off very well. And then in the evening, we all came back to the Orange Gate, which was the biggest gate. And I don't know how many hundreds of people there were. Because you came from London.
That's right, yeah.
And did Jessie come with you?
As a baby. I mean, yes. She was a tiny, not
yes,
yet one baby.
That. And then we all gathered round the Orange Gate, and we all had candles and sang We Shall Survive.
Yes, that's right.
I don't sing that anymore. We've survived, and not enough. But that's what we did. And that did get into the papers, because a lot of stuff never got into the papers at all, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Not everybody knew about it, though it was interesting because I went round the world twice in the next 3 or 4 years with my husband, who was asked to go around the world to visit universities and schools and all sorts of things, because he'd been a professor all his adult life, and he gave up the university and came to take over the Polytechnic, because there was a great deal of discussion. So many people were going and taking a degree, and then they didn't know what to do because there weren't enough jobs. I mean, it wasn't bad at that time, but it was bad enough for people to start thinking. And also my husband, who was very practical about these things, was saying out loud, I don't think these people should all be taking a degree. They should be taking trade training so that we've got hundreds of people ready to work in the factories or building or whatever. And not only will it be good for the country, but also good for the people. We don't want all these people leaving school. Well, now it's got worse because I think they have to stay till 18, don't they?
So yeah. Dreadful. Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
You know, and they're not, yes. And I mean, they're, with so many of them, the last two or three years at school, it's a complete waste of time for them. And then people wonder why there's such a trouble with the youth. Well, you don't need to wonder, you just have a look. And so my husband was very outspoken about this. He was on a lot of national committees and all this stuff. And so he was asked to go round. I think, first of all, we visited universities and colleges to see what they were doing. And how they did training. I remember we went to somewhere in America, I can't remember, great big city anyway, where dental training and medical training was very important. And they had only just decided that in their first year, all these students must take time in a dental surgery or doctor's
surgery,
looking, seeing what happened when the patients went in there. Because you've got so many people who might be brilliant at cutting up people but had never actually spoken to a patient. I know it sounds ridiculous now, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yeah.
So you wore your badge. You wore your badge on the international
Greenham
badge.
On my
clothes,
traveling the world.
And I'm fortunately, I don't know whether it was because I'd always been in education or perhaps anybody could have done it, but my husband, being on official tour, got first class everywhere. So we were allowed to use the first class money for me to go. And we didn't go first class, obviously. So it was very lucky for me. But it was interesting because almost everywhere I went, and I always asked to go into the medical department and the art department, was what I was really interested in.
Yeah.
And almost everywhere I went, people commented on the fact that I got a Greenham badge and what was Greenham doing. And they're very interested.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't expect people in Australia or South America to know anything about it.
No,
in Japan.
They did, which was very nice to know that.
Yeah.
It was very interesting.
Good, yeah.
Do you want to do the last questions now?
Yes.
Sorry.
No, that was great.
That was really interesting, actually.
It was great, Mar. Well done.
Yeah, really, really well done, right, let me have a look. How would you sum up your experience in a few words, do you think?
I'm not one for a few words.
No, that's fine.
I either am a silent or talk a lot.
No in between.
Well, I think the experience was, it was very moving.
Yeah.
And It was very interesting because it meant that a group of women were doing this. We didn't have anything to do with men at all.
No.
I mean, we weren't like the green and yellow kids who wouldn't let the men anywhere near.
Really?
But we didn't speak about the men who were helping. And a lot of them did help in a lot
yeah.
of ways
yeah.
in the background.
Yeah.
But none of them ever stayed at the camp. They
no.
weren't allowed to stay there or actually even go into the fires or anything like that. And it was the first thing that we knew. It was a thing at that time that actually nobody talked about the suffragettes.
No, that's
really?
Right. That was all
but
hidden.
You've only recently there's been all this.
That's right.
Really?
Oh, I mean, it's ludicrous when you think that I and all the people of my age went right through school
yeah.
and never once knew anything about suffragettes. And unless you had a mother who was interested in this, which my mother was not,
no,
then you just never knew anything about
wow.
women having any power whatsoever.
That's crazy.
And I think by the time that this started, I was a bit more sensible than I had been when I was married, but it never, ever, for one second, occurred to me that this was a really stupid setup. My husband was very, very busy the whole time because he was always doing a new degree or report for something or whatever. Anyway, he did work all the time. But I actually worked all the time as well. The whole time I was married, I always did a job, and quite often it was a full-time job,
mm.
which was teaching. And I liked to teach in downtown areas.
Yeah.
And I mostly, if I could, taught the older children. So I was teaching full time. I'd got two children with 2 years between them. And I did everything. And I made sure that before my husband came home in the evening, the children probably would be more or less ready for bed. And if they weren't, they would go and have a bath with him, perhaps. That would be quite fun for a little while. But normally it was me who looked after the children entirely. I did all the cooking, I did all the washing, I did all the cleaning. For a little while I did have a helper who used to cook a cake in the afternoon. It was Grey Grey. She used to cook me a cake every time she came. She came twice a week in the afternoons. And my husband was often home and he was sitting in his study doing God knows what. And my helper would be, well, Grey Grey used to take you out for walks
yes,
all the time.
Yes.
And then I had another much older lady who looked after them. And she had actually been trained as a house worker at some time.
Yeah.
So she used to madly clean things and I could never find anything. Miss Bizamp, her name was. And she disapproved of me very much because she thought anybody going to work, good Lord, earth do you think you're doing, leaving the children for me to look after, which she,
wow.
she liked looking after them. She was very, very kind. And in fact, even after we left to go to America and after we didn't use her anymore, she used to send saving stamps for you and Joe every Christmas.
Sweet.
But
so words for Greenham, moving, you said it was moving,
yes.
and then it makes you think of your role as a woman and
yeah.
as a mother.
Well, it didn't make me think, I certainly didn't think, well, I'm not going to do all this stuff at home. It just never occurred to me.
Mm.
We were just glad that, I mean, all the women were obviously against war.
Yes.
And a lot of us had fathers who'd been in the Second World War and grandparents who'd been in the First World War.
Yeah.
Both my father and my husband's father had been in the First World War, but they would never talk about it at all. They'd both been wounded very, very badly. And my father-in-law was taken home to get the wounds sorted out in his legs, and they promptly sent him to war again
yeah.
when his chest was ruined, and that's what he died of eventually.
Mm.
Wow.
But we all knew that this war was terrible.
Yeah.
Mm.
And we weren't really grumbling about a position of women. We were
right.
really anti-war in,
right.
in
yeah.
entirely.
Okay.
So.
Lovely. I don't know.
Last question.
Just trying to think of what have I got on what have I missed out? What I don't know if I've done this before. What moment would sum up Greenham for you? What sort of
Well, the best moment was after we gathered all around the whole camp, we were all outside.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of women.
Yeah, embrace the base.
Yeah.
Outside with a candle
yeah.
and singing. That was
yeah.
the...
Okay.
That was the moment that I should think everybody
yeah,
would
it was
remember.
It was terrific.
Then.
It was so uplifting, wasn't it? And we felt that we'd done something. It was a real achievement and a real sense of solidarity.
I think one of the problems, in a way, was that nobody was used to taking charge of things.
No.
So I'm sure if it happened now, for one thing, which wouldn't be very good, there probably would be some women who got to be in charge.
Mm.
But it, in another way, I'm sure a lot of things could have been better if there had been some women in charge.
Right.
But, I mean, nobody wanted to be.
No.
And they all did their own.
Yeah, that was a big part of it, wasn't it? Not having a hierarchy.
Yeah.
No bosses.
But they didn't, I mean, people were not interested. Well, they never thought about feminism in those days.
Well, I don't know about that, because the 70s was very big, 60s was very big, and now we're in the 80s. So there was a big feminist movement that then became a big raft for the peace movement. I mean, the peace movement didn't like the Greenham women at first because
well,
they were secretive.
You say there was a feminist movement, it probably was. Well, I'm sure there was, if you say so, and you belong to it. But most people didn't know anything about it.
No, I've fair enough.
And I mean, as far as I was concerned, Margaret and...
Anne?
Two other... No, not Anne. Anne wasn't a feminist, good Lord.
Okay, Margaret then.
Margaret, and there were two other women. Now, this was four women. Four wives out of
the
whole
50s.
University staff
okay, yeah.
who were in any way whatsoever working.
Really? Yeah.
No, I mean, women were at home once you got married.
In the 50s.
You
yeah.
stayed at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the four of us, there was somebody else because there were five of us, went to several meetings and we just used to go and sit in the front row with stony face. I mean, not that it ever did the slightest good, but it made us feel as though we were...
Yeah.
I mean, at that time, well, I know now in lots of situations, but at that time, in everything, women got less money than men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you'd got a PhD and you were working in a department where there was somebody who'd just got a BA or what, he would get less
That's
than
right.
you. Women just got more.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed.
Unfortunately not, no.
I can put that on record.
It's about 30%, isn't it now?
Yeah.
But it didn't occur. I mean, I was teaching all the time from the time I was married, that was in 1950.
Yeah.
Until, what, I don't know.
Well, till the early 80s, you retrained as a craft design
well,
and technology teacher.
That's true.
And then you were in your late 50s, and they said to you at Bristol Council, isn't your husband the director of the Polytechnic? Shouldn't you be looking after him? You're 55, and your family's left home, and you've just retrained.
No, he was quite serious, the chairman, because I did a retraining course to teach, because when I'd been teaching, It's only the sort of rather dull children, non-academic, they would say, and they were sent to do woodwork and needlework, woodwork and metalwork.
Right.
And that was only the boys, the girls didn't do that.
No.
And then suddenly there was an extraordinary suggestion that girls might do woodwork and metalwork, but of course they hadn't got anybody to teach them because they'd only got men. And most of those men weren't trained as teachers, they were craftspeople who just came in. Mm. If they were a carpenter, they'd come in and teach them, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So they had a training year for anybody who was interested in teaching those subjects, which I was, because it had always annoyed me.
Yeah.
That this was, you know, they were discarded into wood and metal.
Yeah.
And I thought that was dreadful.
Mm.
So I did this year's training, and at the end of it, I applied for a job in Bristol.
Mm.
And when I went for the interview, all these men, I mean, women didn't come into any of this.
Wow.
And the chairman, I knew him because I'd met him at lots of things at the Polytechnic. I mean, that was another thing which never occurred to me, that I would say, no, I don't want to go to that. I spent half the time going to things with my husband.
Mm.
And this chap was chairman, and he just suddenly said to me, hello, surely you're Mary, wife of the Polytechnic director. I said, yes. So he turned to the others. He says, well, it's so nice of you to come, but it's very unlikely that we could consider you because I'm quite sure that your time is completely occupied.
Wow.
Looking after your husband.
Wow.
But he
didn't. It's in the 80s.
I mean, really, if somebody said to me that now, well, they wouldn't dare to say it.
No.
No, it'd be in the papers now.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
right.
Not.
That's right.
So I just said, oh, thank you, and walked out. And that was that.
Jeez.
Extraordinary.
You were really upset.
And I never
you were
did
really
get a job.
No, you were really, really disappointed and taken aback after making all that effort.
Extraordinary.
No, it's a nightmare.
Like you're his carer, wasn't
it? Yes, that's right. Like you're his carer. No, that's right. Well done, Emily. That's a good line.
A completely different line.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
For women. And I think the Greenham, the fact that it was all women.
Yeah.
It was a very pleasant feeling for women to do this. I mean, there were a lot more women who would have done it if their husbands had let them.
Probably, yeah.
Well, I'm sure I knew women who would have helped, but,
yeah,
no, so-and-so, he doesn't want me to do it. You didn't feel badly about it, it was just how it was.
How it was, yeah.
Which is extraordinary, really.
Yeah.